Brevity codes are designed to convey complex information with a few words or codes. Think of it as a short hack to key information. On this podcast, it's about sharing insights, success stories, and personal journeys across a broad spectrum of disciplines. Welcome to the Brevity Code. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Brevity Code podcast. Today, I've got Rahul Sandal, who's an awesome dude, and I'm excited about this conversation we're going to have today. The basis for my curiosity today is in talking with you, you are the VP Marketing Micron. And it's a public traded company. They're doing $20-25 billion a year with a $120 billion market cap. Yep. And then there's garage startup Ryan. And I just thought we'd have a fun conversation today about the contrast between how someone, or perhaps contrast and similarities between how you might approach marketing at such a level and how contrasted with, you know, a garage startup.
Yeah.
And so I thought that we would, I don't know, man, I just, that's just where I'm coming from. And I'm fascinated to see like what type of similarity, what type of creative, you know, ideas and things are driven at both levels. And, you know, what it's like to have, in my view, and maybe you don't feel it, but like the pressure, the pressure of that gig to me from my perception of what it might be versus reality. So we're going to kind of get into all that stuff today. But before we do, I think we should maybe give the folks that are tuning in a little bit of background on yourself and probably a much better intro. If you would mind giving us a couple minutes on your role, how you came to be, a little bit of your path.
Yeah. Thanks, firstly, Ryan, for having me on the show. I was till recently, very recently, the VP of marketing and global head of marketing for Micron, small semiconductor company, based out of Boise, Idaho, but global operations. I joined Micron in their consumer business. So they actually have a consumer brand called Crucial. And I used to be a tech geek and gamer, and I built PC gaming rigs. And so I knew that brand. I didn't know Micron. And by the way, some of the brands you worked for, I kind of knew Paul Frank before I knew Micron. So, you know, I think from a brand standpoint, it's Micron's a great company. And I worked for a VR company in Taiwan, based out of the Bay Area. And some recruiter called me and said, hey, Micron's really interested in you, and they have this consumer business. And that's how I kind of came to Micron.
And you were at Xbox.
Yep. Prior to Micron, I was at Amazon Prime Video.
Amazon Prime, yeah.
Before that, I was at Microsoft at Xbox first, and then I worked on the HoloLens, which was kind of their big play into augmented reality or AR. And then before that, bunch of gaming startups, software mostly, and game development, online publishing. And I started my career in India. I grew up in India, went to school there, did have an MBA. And post-MBA, I started my career very much like you in the music business, as an A&R person for EMI India, which was in India known as the Gramophone Company of India. Started in A&R and did a bunch of stuff, and they sent me overseas.
Yeah, the music background that we share is pretty interesting. I mean, I literally graduated college, and I was like, I'm either going to do music or fashion. And, you know, was obviously pulled in a certain direction. But I interned at Capitol Records back in the day, and music's still a huge influence in my life, and how I had a huge influence, actually, culturally speaking, even at Paul Frank, too. So, yeah, we share that. Were you, speaking of music, let's just dive in. You know, were you able to infuse, did that have an influence on the way you approached marketing at a brand level, at a global brand level, in terms of, I don't know, just the creative process there? And, you know,
yeah, I think it did two things. You know, one, as a kid growing up, I was very curious about technology. And it kind of goes back. I think my dad used to travel to Japan quite a bit. He was the South Asia CMO for Toyota Motors, so the trucks division in India. And he once brought back this solar-powered AM/FM radio. And growing up in India, you know, even in the 70s or 80s, your choices of entertainment were pretty limited. The government kind of controlled a lot of what you could listen to or not. And this, I was really intrigued because now I had this portable device powered by the sun, and I could listen to cricket games or music shows or, you know, on that device. So I think music definitely influenced. But for me, where kind of liberal arts or music or entertainment meets technology at that intersection, that kind of really kind of gets me going around what does a brand really mean and what's the brand experience, right, at that intersection.
Yeah, right. So how do you approach marketing? I mean, that's a very broad question, but, you know, how, I guess, what are some of those things that, besides music, that inspire you? Mm-hmm. And is it more on the brand side of the consumer reach or the brand reach, or is mm-hmm. it the messaging strategy? Like, what gets you going?
I think the first is understanding the audience. Mm. And there could be many audiences, right? When you're a large company like Micron, you truly have multiple audiences. You have customers, partners, ecosystem, the government, employees, the large audience sets. I think for me, it's the, what is the experience the audience has with the product?
Yeah.
And that gets me. Like, that makes me think. I love doing the research around it. I love talking to people. So kind of working with your audience and then working back. Kind of defining what that brand experience is. What does it mean? Like, what is the emotional connection? Not just kind of owning the product, but what is that emotional, what is the umami?
Yeah. You know,
the hidden taste of that experience is kind of what I find intriguing, right?
Yeah. So thinking about the contrast between big and small, you know, again, Paul Frank being a, you know, something that started in my garage, mm-hmm. I could touch and feel at the consumer mm-hmm. level, right? There were friends of mine. I was influenced by, you know, going to punk shows. So it was very organic for me. When you're at a large organization in a glass tower, my vision of this, how do you, like, for lack of a better word, like, how do you keep it real? Like, how do you get down to that granular level? So I would ask that question. And then further, like, how do you translate that, right, through approval processes and through,
yep.
like, how do you do that?
Yeah, I've never been too worried about approval processes.
Okay. I like that.
I'm a bit of a renegade. I like working with teams who want to push the envelope. But I'll answer your first one first, and we'll tell you some funny stories about approvals. When I came into, moved from the consumer side of Micron, Crucial, came over to corporate, there was no differentiation in the industry. You know, it's a semiconductor industry. It's a commodity business, some would call it, memory mm-hmm. and storage. And even, you know, there was some level of brand building, which Intel has done and AMD has done and NVIDIA has done. Pretty brilliant brand building there. Qualcomm has done it. But mostly it's just commodity, you know?
Yeah.
So I think, and everything was not differentiated. A lot of blues, a lot of blue color everywhere, pictures of computers, stock images of people shaking hands, sitting across the conference table kind of stuff, right? And you're like, so I think the first step for me was like, okay, who are the audiences? And, you know, and how do we be authentic? And it's a commodity product. How do you build that emotional connection? And when I joined, we were about to start talking about our U.S. investments with the CHIPS Act. And, you know, we were planning all these events and activities. And And I realized one of the key audiences was communities, and not only government officials, but actual communities. We showed up in, we announced Syracuse, we showed up in Clay, New York, upstate New York, held a big event. The President Biden came, the governor, and a bunch of senators and local officials. And when we announced that investment, and talking about 40, 50, even more, 1,000 jobs, which will get created in that community over the, you know, by the end of the decade or in the next 10 years or whatever the time frame would be, I mean, that's life-changing.
Absolutely.
It's life-changing, right? Yeah. And that community then ends up having a relationship with the brand of Micron. And I remember we did this announcement. The president came. It was a massive event, a lot of fun. And pretty beat, you know, working a few weeks and a few months without too much sleep. So a bunch of us went out to a local bar in downtown Syracuse, and we still had our Micron shirts on. There were people randomly showing up buying us drinks. So here we are, semiconductor company, make memory and storage widgets. We were being treated like a music star because we were able to form that emotional connection. So that kind of sparked, hey, this means something more than what the speeds and feeds are. And the second audience we look at a lot is our own employees. You know, almost coming up at 50,000 employees worldwide, spread across the whole world.
What would you say the median age is for an employee there?
It's a, currently at Micron, I think it's a good mix. It's a growing company and it's the culture is evolving. We definitely have a very large pool of employees who've been with the company more than 20 years.
Okay.
And then we're also growing a set of employees and employee pool, which is less than 5 years and an equal number of between 5 to 20. So it's a good mix of folks, a lot of engineers, a lot of technicians, a lot of people who work in technical roles in the fab and in places like Taiwan or Singapore, in the U.S., very R&D and ops-focused company, you know. So we were trying to kind of get into what makes a person commit to a 20-year career. What is that emotional connection to the brand, you know?
Right. So in a sense, in one way, almost entertaining and marketing to yourselves, right? To the various, to the old guard and to the new guard, right? And what, I don't know, like what feeds their motivation for being there? Like you said, like they're, like what is the emotion that they're feeling? Like how can you reinforce that? You know, again, same, you know, we had youth culture. We were, our average age was probably 25 years old. So, you know, we allowed in our offices, this was mid 90s to early 2000s. We'd have dogs running around the office. Like, I'm not talking one or two. I'm talking like, if you were an employee there, you could bring your dog. We had like 15, 20 dogs. Mm-hmm. So many, in fact, we had to build a dog park in the back parking lot at some point. And we would pipe in music and we would have DJs come in just in the middle of the day and just spin music. And I know you know, for those of you listening now, you're like, oh yeah, well, we do that. Well, in the mid 90s into the early 2000s, nobody was doing that.
Yep.
And so, but that, you know, that was a means of entertaining ourselves and, you know, reinforcing, you know, our ethos and the things that we stand for and those brand pillars. And a lot of that was a lot of like really indie thought. Like you said, you know, I don't do well with rules and bosses either. You know, I just, that's a hard thing.
Yeah.
So, I guess if I may ask this question, you know, on rules, it begs the question, this issue of DEI, right? So how, at your level, did you handle implementation and compliance at kind of where you're, I don't know, you're, I don't know. I mean, again, I'm not in that world, so I don't know if you're forced, but you to a certain extent, you have to bend to a bit of regulation?
No, not really. There was, at least I don't recall being part of any group which had a regulation on it. I think firstly, I think personally for me, I'm incredibly proud that Micron has a strong foundation in diversity, equality, and inclusion. We are a global company, and respect for all is, you know, our vision. Our statement kind of talks about transforming how the world uses information to enrich life for all. It kind of goes to the core of Micron's ethos and connects people to each other. So at no point have I felt that was a rule. By the way, I was executive co-chair of Micron's Women's Leadership Network, kind of serving as a male ally there. The underlying principle always was you hire the best. There is no compromise. You hire, retain, develop the best talent that you can. And I don't think we've ever compromised, at least, you know, I can't recall even going back in history and studying Micron's history, that was ever compromised, right? That would have been compromised. But if it means that we want to support former vets, we hire a bunch of, we have a Verge community, which are veterans. We support in many countries LGBTQ plus communities. We are very thoughtful about providing the right growth opportunities to our female employees, because in the tech sector you're grossly underrepresented when it comes to women. You know, women form at least 50-ish% of our workforce, but in the tech industry, it's less. The number, I think, somewhere is less than 18% or 18-20%, and Micron's higher than the industry average. But a lot of work has to be done. So no, I never felt that was a rule. In fact, I'm incredibly proud of Micron's commitment to being thoughtful about what does it mean, and having discussions, and, you know, how do you implement that, and being a responsible global citizen is very critical.
Got it. So what is your, kind of keeping on this line, like, what is your management style? You're a very happy, you exude, you're a positive guy. I get that.
Yeah.
You're a happy guy.
Yeah.
But yet you have a very intense job. It's a massive responsibility. You're running, you know, probably large budgets and lots of different teams on a global basis with lots of different objectives, and you got shareholders to answer to. And how do you stay happy? How do you, where does that come from? Because I can feel it from you. Like, I don't know that I would be like that, Rahul. I feel like I would be a walking stress ball.
Yeah. It's
how,
like,
do you do that?
I don't know. It's like asking, Novak Djokovic has been playing tennis, all these injuries, and still shows up and loves doing it. Yeah. I just love doing what I do. I think from a, if I can share, like, you know, I kind of have this, I was, when I worked up in Orange County for a gaming startup called Reloaded Games, our CEO kind of had this little framework. It was on his desk, and he hadn't fully developed it. There were four pillars. And on his desk, there was a compass. There was a measuring tape. There was a pair of headphones and a pair of dice. And that kind of got me, and he kind of told me the four things which kind of guided him. And it really had a profound impact on me, because one of the things you have to do as a people leader or as a marketer is think about scale.
Yeah.
You know, you start in a garage, but then you're thinking about scale. And next thing you know, you're in Taiwan and China and you're talking.
Yeah.
So scale is important to me. So kind of simple framework. First, you know where you're going. Know where you're headed, right? Clear sense of direction.
Yeah.
Clear North Star. You share it with people. You buy people in onto that North Star. I think it makes life much more manageable to measure everything. I think a lot of times I see people in teams or large organizations not happy because of the interpersonal conflict or strong opinions. They come into a meeting, I have a strong opinion, and somebody else has a strong opinion, and people don't really get along, and then it creates conflict and becomes a source of unhappiness. So I always say measure everything. Like, hey, just keep your ego out the door. You have a thing, go test it. Let's see the numbers. Somebody else has it. Let's let the numbers win. Third one, earn trust and have fun. So that's your third pillar. We spend a third of our waking lives with the people we work with.
Right.
Third, you know. Yeah. So you got to earn trust. You got to make that work setting a lot of fun. We have a lot of fun in what we do. We even kind of mix in things like volunteering at the Idaho Food Bank and then going for beer after that as a team activity, right? Earn trust, have fun. And the last one is be bold and take risk, right? I just do those pretty much seamlessly through my professional career, and kind of it is so rewarding, and you have fun and you meet great people, and glass is always full. Sometimes it's got half water, half air, but it's always full. Yeah. So I'm just that kind of person.
Yeah. And I mean, I would imagine that, you know, that leadership style really, you know, it's infectious. If they see you not as a tyrant, and as someone that is open to new ideas and fostering creativity and, you know, all those aspects, as opposed to ruling with an iron fist and this is the box that you're going to be in, it just is not going to go the right direction. Still, though, very impressive, because it's still a tremendous role, and it's a lot of responsibility, and to maintain that is work in itself, right? I'm sure you course correct from time to time, say, well, hold on, wait,
I think working at startups gave me a little bit of the steely backbone, you know, like,
yeah,
because you make mistakes and you kind of learn from them. You pick yourself up and then don't repeat the mistake, you know. Xbox, the culture was very similar, like, hey, go break stuff.
Yeah.
You know, Xbox kind of almost worked like its own company within Microsoft for many years. And we were constantly breaking things and trying things out and running, you know, consumer panels and figuring things out. And if that's kind of the thing. And the other one, kind of, you know, leaning into a lot of spiritual and religious literature. The Bible talks about it. And I know the Bhagavad Gita in India, the Hindu religion talks about it. I know the Quran talks about it. Like, so many religious, the Buddhist faith, you know, treat others as you want to be treated. So if you bring that to work and say, okay, what kind of manager would I hate? Just don't be
don't
that
be
manager.
That guy.
Just don't be that guy.
Yeah.
Or gal. Like, just don't be that manager, right? Just just treat people the way you would want to be treated. So, you know, I don't breed dumb people's neck. And I believe people are coming into work, and these are highly qualified people, and they all are motivated, and they all want to give it to the best. And just let them run with it. Like, let them run with ideas. And I think a job of a leader in that space also is not to remove roadblocks, but not to create them.
Yeah.
And I find sometimes managers struggle with that. They struggle with, what is my true role? It's just been a lot of fun, though.
Yeah. Reminds me of my first out of college. I worked for Massimo, the clothing brand that went on to do license deal with Target and become huge. But my boss, I had two bosses. Moss was one of my bosses, and this guy, Jason Johnson, was another boss. Fantastic. Because these are my first two, like, you know, experiences in the fashion biz. And so I answered to that. He was the director of marketing at the time. And we'd come up with these marketing campaigns, but he was the wildest guy ever. Imagine, like, this kind of Johnny Depp character. He had a glass office, but then when he would do his ad campaigns, he would put newspaper up in the window, and then he would put Gypsy Kings on full blast in the whole office.
Yep.
And he wouldn't emerge from his office. I mean, this could go on for a couple of days. Yep. He'd be in there, you'd hear him singing, and you'd hear Gypsy Kings, and he wouldn't let anyone know what he was doing. And he would emerge with, you know, the next campaign. And I just remember, like, just fresh out of college, and, like, you have this idea of, like, what the corporate world might look like. And I just remember being so blown away and so, like, inspired, like, whoa, okay, it doesn't have to be like this. It can, I don't have to wear a suit and like be this conformist person that's stuck in a box. And here's this wild guy with this huge mustache that, you know, just this very eccentric dude who lived in a warehouse and was incredibly well read, but had a seventh grade education.
Yeah.
And he just broke every mold and every preconceived notion of what I thought
was corporate life or working in a company. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think for me growing up, it was very inspired by my dad, you know, who also was a marketer, is retired now, but is a marketer, loves trucks, worked for Toyota, but worked for a Japanese company. So he, you know, I remember seeing him every morning wearing his suit and wearing a tie and going to work, right? But seeing that how much he cared about the craft of marketing and the experience with customers, and he would talk about cars and how Toyota kind of changed the automobile market in the world, it was fascinating. For me, starting my career, you know, all I ever wanted was to be in entertainment, or like I said, the intersection of technology and entertainment. And I think my parents convinced me, like, India is a very competitive education market. And, you know, growing up in the 70s, graduating high school in 91, graduating college in 94, it still wasn't the India which you see today. You know, it was just started coming out of its shell. The markets were opening up to the world and jobs were not that readily available, you know. And so my parents said, look, all we want you to do is just get an MBA degree, like get something in master's. We'll fund you. We'll pay for your bill if you want to go do anything after that.
What was your focus with the master's?
Marketing.
It was. Okay.
Marketing and international business. Okay. I tried finance. My summer internship was with a global trading, Japanese headquartered global trading company called Marubeni. Great company. But I just didn't care for it, man. I was so unhappy. And I said, okay, I tried finance. Not for me. And my second year, very first or second week, I found out that eventually this company, the record label, will be, their parent company is going to be out recruiting in that year in B schools. And that is it. My second year of master's was only about preparing for what would be an eventual interview. And I was very focused on that. And they came to campus. They were interviewing like 30 people from my campus. I was 26 on the list. Last name is Sandel. S kind of falls low on that list. And I was just praying that they don't just offer anybody the job. At least they get to meet me. And they offered me a role in the parent company. And they said, which company would you like to work for? And I said, I want to work for the Gramophone company. And they said, why? That company pays the lowest in our group. You know, you should look at they had a cell phone business and a retail business. And I said, no, I don't care. I'll take half. But I want to work in the music business. So I think I've also been very blessed, right? So if you spent a career doing things you love doing, you generally will be a very happy and optimistic and a positive person. So I've been very lucky.
Yeah, I love that. I love that you you leaned into the thing that drew you close to it, right? Instead of maybe that other path, maybe it would have been more lucrative, but you'd have maybe been miserable. Who knows, right?
Yeah, and I think lucrative to me is just a whole different meaning.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's a combination of what's in your investment accounts and then what's in your heart kind of thing. Like, you know, it's like, look, the money's great. I'm not going to lie. Please, for anyone listening out there, please work hard and make sure you can pay the bills and you're saving money. So all that is very important. So I won't bullshit there, but if you can do it while being happy and making a difference and doing things that you love doing and doing it with people you love working with, then pick that path. It's a much better path.
So what do you find sort of the most rewarding part, could be of your day, of your job? Like what is that to you?
I think the most rewarding part is trying to solve complex things with people. I just kind of love that problem solving aspect of the marketing job or brand development and or brand strategy.
Is that the most rewarding and challenging at the same time?
It is. Yeah. You know, it is trying to influence people is a challenging and rewarding thing. Being in creative reviews, I love it. I love being in creative reviews. Brainstorming with creative folks or digital folks around what should the tone and voice be on social. That kind of stuff is super rewarding. But I think it really comes down to people. Like for me, the greatest joy, like, you know, I'm taking some time off and I'm not sharing right now where I'm going next, and I'll be sharing more of that later. But leaving Micron is kind of hard, you know. I wanted to give myself, I've never had a break in my career, so I wanted to give myself a little break. Like the very first day, I was like reaching for my phone and I'm, you know,
right.
Like, I wonder how the team's doing. Like, you know, and so I think that to me is the most important, but also influencing others and being part of a creative journey is really important to me as well.
Yeah. I mean, so, okay, you're kind of in between right now.
Yeah.
So what does downtime look like for you? Are you like, are you mowing the lawn? Are you like, are you reading books? Like what are you?
You know me, I'm not mowing lawns.
You're not mowing lawns. I know.
I'm a bit like you, I'm not mowing lawns. I think, you know, I don't know you that well personally. We're neighbors and, you know, we've talked a few times, but I've definitely know the kind of stuff you've done and I'm kind of inspired. I keep busy and I see how you've kind of done your home and that kind of stuff inspires me too. I've been doing that quite a bit. What keeps me busy right now, I write. I have a blog. It's myname.com, rahulsandal.com.
Okay.
I love building stuff. So, well, let me caveat that. I like designing stuff. I don't physically like to build stuff. I don't have the patience for it. I'm building PC rigs right now. I just did one with a really talented group here in Boise. It's a father and son. They build great PCs. So I built one with them. I designed it. Now I'm building a second one. I'm setting up the most perfect office environment for... I'm tinkering a lot with AI. I think I've signed up for more subscriptions than I would like. I just signed up for one today on a service which lets me record one video of myself, make myself an avatar, and then you can just feed in any amount of language text and it makes the character speak in those languages.
Wow.
So I'm doing all of that. I'm reading. I haven't read HBR, Harvard Business Review, in a long time. They do some great pieces on brand strategies. So I've gone and bought a bunch of HBRs and I'm reading those. Spending time with the kids. We're going on vacation. We're going on vacation to Taiwan. I love that country. And so I'm taking the wife and kids to Taiwan. So yeah, that kind of stuff. That's the usual.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
That's great. It sounds like there's a bit of renaissance there, a bit of new exploration, maybe as you kind of enter this next phase. Mm-hmm. Like it sounds like almost a second level of or third level of education happening. And you obviously, again, on top of the happiness that you exude, there's a genuine curiosity that I think you have for learning and for people. And I think that serves you really well in your role. I mean, and I it's inspiring. Like I feel like everyone needs a little cup of Rahul in the morning. I'm telling you, man, like I could really feel it. And I feel like I misstepped a bit back in the day too. Like, you know, as when you're a garage startup and you're, I was 22 years old running a company, you just have, or I had no foundation for leadership skills. And if you've never kind of been in a situation that you're faced with these problems you're seeing for the first time, you're going to trip and fall in front of everyone. And there's bruised ego that gets thrown in there. And it's just like, I don't know. I was like, I don't know that I was, you know, speaking of leadership qualities at that point, I wish I had the maturation that I have in my older years now, and the calmness mm-hmm. and probably the gratitude and the humility that I now feel like I have, but had no grasp of it then. So I don't know, man. You know, it just, that's, you live and learn, but it's, I think we were successful despite ourselves, but.
And I would love to know a little bit, you know, about that stage. Like, so you and a bunch of friends, you guys start this thing, you create a really iconic, it's almost impossible to create an iconic fashion brand, right? And you create this brand, you do really well with it, and then you, I think, started a second brand.
Yeah.
And then you kind of like, wasn't that almost hard, like impossible to kind of step away? How do you step away?
Altogether?
Yeah.
Like after the...
After the second one or whatever. And then now you have another brand. You have the coffee thing. Like,
yeah.
But it's not the same, I guess. Are you still kind of morning to night? Are you still like beating the pavement? And-
I like that question. I feel like... How do I say? I feel like my journey with the brand, the Paul Frank brand, it was enough, right? It really was.
Yeah.
It was an action-packed time from November 1995 was the garage. The sale was in 2010. So 15-year ride there and another brand I did after that for another few years. So, you know, coming close to the culmination of 20 years, you know, having done something from the garage to 65 countries in, you know, a licensed business and all this kind of crazy stuff in between there. I felt like it was enough. And I, like you said, it's really hard to build a global brand. Like I don't, you know, does part of the back of my mind, like my ego, like you could do it again. Well, I don't know. And it also takes incredible amounts of energy and passion. And I, you know, at my middle age now, I don't know if I'm being honest with myself that I possess that tenacity, that level of engagement. And you know what it takes to wake up every day from the second you wake up to when you lay your head down at night to bring that level, whether that's leadership or just the energy, you know, or the true north every day.
Yeah.
So I don't think I have that fight in me. I'm still an old dog. I still feel like I got a little fight left in me, but I do feel really fulfilled with my journey. And, you know, I met my wife that way and some close friends and have started a family because of that. And it has afforded me the ability to go and explore other things in life. And now it's more of a quiet life. And something I've kind of always envisioned was this more quiet, like just getting off the train and taking it down a few notches. Yeah. And, you know, we have a coffee shop and a boutique and we do a few other things. And really now too, it's a lot of on the philanthropic side of things. And it's a lot of give back. So I love speaking at high schools. And I mean, I'll do a middle of my kids, middle school, high school, spoke a lot at universities and my TED talk, like any chance that I get to pay that experience forward and share all my mistakes or inspiration. Like I said, I was a wayward kid. And, you know, if I found a path to success, like literally anyone can do that.
Yeah.
And so I love sharing that story.
That's awesome. It's inspiring because one thing I'll never say never. I don't think I'm wired to be a entrepreneur CEO because
I don't agree with you, but okay.
I think for me, one is just, you know, remember I said, like, if I'm doing what I love doing, that's kind of where my source of energy is. That's where my kind of chi is, you know?
Yeah.
And I think the dealing with the bankers and the VCs and the logistics and the operations and the legal, like, that kind of stuff would like just, I don't know. I've not done it, so I don't know. But I think that's why when I did a bunch of startups and, you know, we were able to get moderate success, but never had that big exit. And then I kind of walked into Xbox. And like, I had so much fun because I was like focused, like all that energy was focusing on to launching a game or launching a console and doing like cool stuff with the brand and talking to salespeople and being like that stuff. Like really, I found a whole new gear. And I think coming to Micron was like fascinating, right? Crucial is such a huge brand. It's like a subculture kind of brand, right? Like it's for PC gamers and people who build rigs and that kind of stuff. So it's really, really cool. But then coming to corporate to me was just so rewarding. Because I was now kind of dealing with multiple audiences, customers, partners, governments, employees. And then, you know, when I was leaving, when I joined corporate and I met a bunch of folks saying, hey, you know, employees and partners, and like, what do you think about Micron? Most of what I heard was, yeah, you know, it's pretty much like any other company. It's a commodity company. It's a memory company. I'm like, okay, how do I change that? Like, how do I inspire and lead a team and get, you know, and what's surprising is most of my team already had the ideas, and this my job was then to kind of influence people and sell the story. And while leaving, we did something pretty, I think, career milestone. After, I think, almost 20 plus years, we changed Micron's brand. So I led the team through only 3 times in history in a 45-year-old company.
It's very sensitive stuff.
Yeah. So we launched a whole new brand.
Yeah.
Launched it, took it, you know, we were in NASDAQ. We showed up on Times Square. We did some really cool things with it. And when I was leaving, a lot of people said that, you know, I can't imagine this is Micron. Like, this is so cool. Yeah. This company is cool and the videos are cool. And like, we brought like cinematic style, Hollywood style, like cinematics to brand videos, you know, and it was like so much fun doing that.
I love that. Love that. That's like that pioneering spirit. And by the way, back to the, I don't want to lose my train of thought here, but I think you would be great as a leader and as doing your own thing. So long as, like you said, I also love that the VC, the bank, I didn't love that stuff either, but you just surround yourself, everyone, you know, that's the old adage, you just surround yourself with people that are smarter than you and you trust that they're going to do their thing. So I think, you know, you as part of a leadership team could be fierce. I mean, just fierce. So, God, where was I going with? Oh, I know. When you are getting to really get to recreate and re-envision a brand, like first of all, that's a huge deal.
Yeah.
You know, at a big sort of entrenched, you know, corporate level, what was the resistance and what was the process? Like, do you have to go through like board reviews and like? How intense is that process and how much did they resist you? Or was it more of like when you and the team came up with it, they were like, yes, we love this. Or like, how was that resistance?
Yeah. You know, so in my case, when I moved over to corporate in 2022, some of that work was already done. So our CEO, my former CEO, Sanjay Mehrotra joined the company, I think, in 2017 or 2018, and set kind of a new vision and values for the company. And somewhere there was like, you know, we've got to evolve this brand. And the former brand had served us really well, like 17, 18 years, right? It was inspired by the founders of the company who kind of designed the first brand and then kind of evolved from there and then. And so that kind of work had already started, but it has stalled. I think with the pandemic and everything, the work had stalled quite a bit. So it does require a lot of approval. The good news was we had a lot of executive buy-in.
Okay.
Like, we need to do this.
They're asking for, we need a refresh. We need some
we need to become more contemporary.
Yeah.
We are not, look, the market profile of Micron's changed, you know, with AI and high performance compute and data centers, is you can't just anymore be a B2B commodity player. You you really have to create the demand pool even for a large B2B company. So all that was kind of the easier part. There was a lot of executive buy-in. I think for me, I kind of came in and said, that won't be enough. Because you've got communities. You're in Boise. You've been here for 46 years. They're used to a certain thing, and suddenly you change. Will people feel alienated, right? You had, like I said, 47, 48, or going up to 50,000 employees. Many of them have been in the company, and they've built this emotional connection. So those were the things which were far more kind of, to me, I was like far more indexed there. So my team and I, and a very, very talented senior director of brand, and we sat down and said, okay, there needs to be a very thoughtful change management.
Yeah.
We need to tell that story first, define the story, what it is, you know, what inspired us. And one of the things about the new brand is it's deeply rooted in our history, in our heritage of silicon. So the colors and the silicon, and we started building these stories. So we started building this change, man. We approached the brand change not purely from a creative lens of what looks cool, but everything we did, we said, how is that going to impact people who care about this brand?
Yeah.
And so we had to extract that emotional connection which our audiences had and pull that through while we were moving away from the design and the shape and the colors, you know. So then, like I said in the beginning, that gets me as well. Like, what is that emotional connection? Can that be transferred? And we were very focused there. And that's what I think it worked well.
Yeah, that's awesome. And again, it sounds like this wasn't an ego art project for you.
Oh, no.
Right?
Massive.
But I could see someone in your position being like, I know what to do. We're going to rebrand this. And it's an art project. And I can put my name on this thing. And, you know, no, there's a lot of consideration and thoughtfulness in what you just said and how you described it. And I think that continues to translate through the success of Micron today. Yep. But I love that the heritage consideration and being mindful of the roots and pushing it and pulling it just far enough, you know, back into this relevant position again with a lot of thought and love and tenderness behind it. And again, not treated like a branding assignment, and hey, how are we distinctive from our competition? It doesn't sound like that was even ever a question that was brought up.
Yeah, it was not a project.
It was not a project. Yeah,
we knew, and I knew fully well that this is going to be one of the most emotional things which employees will go through, and what our communities will go through, and our partners. It's a lot of work, you know.
Yeah.
Partners have to change the logos on their systems and the invoicing. Like, there's a lot of stuff, right?
Yeah.
For a big company like ours.
Yeah, sure.
We have buildings and sites in so many countries, right? How do you do this thing where the last thing you want is what happened to British Airways when they were building when they were sponsoring the London Eye, the big Ferris wheel?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
And, you know, like, I was. Those were things which were getting me paranoid. So for the folks who don't know about this, British Airways and Virgin Atlantic was kind of the up-and-coming airline, and they were looking at inroads into becoming a global airline brand. British Airways was sponsoring the London Eye, which was in construction. I think it was called the British Airways Eye or London Eye or whatever. And so this thing, they build it, the way this Ferris wheel was built flat on the ground, and then the cranes kind of pulled it up to make it stand straight. And while pulling it up, the cranes had a problem. So this thing was stuck halfway on the banks of the Thames River, and Richard Branson saw that as an opportunity and had, he was great, one of the greatest brand thinkers, by the way,
for sure,
of our time.
Agreed,
right?
Yes.
So Branson has these blimps flying around this thing now with signs which said, British Airways can't get it up.
That's amazing.
So now, as a brand guy, working in Micron, knowing that there's going to be emotional connection and knowing, look, we all fully knew well, not everybody's going to be bought in, right? You do this brand and now you're thinking, okay, in the next 90 days, all our facilities are going to have physical signs removed and replaced. The last thing you want is one of those signs not to work at launch. Those things definitely kept us up, right? Or have we considered every cultural aspect that we needed to? Because Micron is a U.S. headquartered company, but we've got over 30,000 employees or 35,000 employees who work outside the U.S. Taiwan, Japan, some of these countries, Malaysia, Singapore, they can be very sensitive countries, India, China. You know, we have a big team in Xi'an. Very sensitive country. So those things, like, I think what that also did was, as a marketer, leaning into the DNA of Micron, we're an engineering company at the core. We're an R&D engineering company, right? We make some of the most advanced products in the world.
Yeah.
And so we are detail-oriented. Marketers, by nature, are not the most detail-oriented. So we had to kind of go collaborate with a bunch of engineers and ops people and say, okay, take a look at this stuff. Tell me if you're hitting, if you're capturing.
Did you do that globally? Did you reach out globally to some of your partners and say, hey, is this?
Yep. We did a bunch of stuff globally. The rollout was meticulous. You know, we did a bunch of, first we did a senior leadership trainings. We did extended leadership team trainings. We did all global VPs training.
So let me ask you this. So when you're, you know, you've got this iteration of what, you know, Micron US wants to do first, and then you start approaching some of your key international partners. Are you're obviously open-minded, again, from the cultural point of view, you want to make sure you're on point and, and all that. But I could see being like, no, wait, hold on. Wait, I know I'm asking for your opinion, but at the end of the day, this is my baby, and I'm not asking for your art direction necessarily. Don't be the creative guy. Hey, we've got this. That's a sensitive thing, right? Like, how do you, you're asking for their opinion, but like, do you really want to hear their opinion?
I think
if they make a major change, you're like, well, hold on. Now you have a problem. You have a communication problem.
Yes. And that, you know, to me, that's a bigger problem than, so firstly, I think I definitely felt like, you know, it was my baby and the team's baby, but I also kind of had the, I guess, you know, you kind of learn humility as you get older. I also had the humility to know that it really wasn't. I was a custodian.
Yeah, that's a good word. Yeah, okay.
Look,
that's a good word.
45-year-old company. I joined in 2019, right? I was not part of the trenches. I just came in. So to know that I'm a custodian and I'm, you know, I'm going to take this, and now hopefully in the next 20, 30 years or even longer, somebody else might change it. So I think keeping that ego a little bit in check was important, but taking feedback and processing is important. But we also have our cases where I've had situations where I've had some engineers call me and on a campaign said, hey, why is that thing like this? You know, let's just make it this. Or and then usually, like, you kind of go explain to them, you know, what brand strategy means. And some of them don't get it. They be insistent. But then you kind of explain to them, like, hey, I never show up at your desk.
Exactly.
And say, hey, why does this thing only have, like, whatever, 2 terabytes of storage? Can you make it, like, 20 terabytes of storage? And you're like, oh, that's not possible. And like, well, so you have your principles and I do have mine.
Yeah.
And
brand
and marketing is as much as a science as engineering is.
Yeah.
And so I think having that mutual respect and being able to hold you on is important.
I love that. And I love what you said about the approaching it from the custodian point of view. You're right. It wasn't yours.
Yeah.
You were merely the guardian at the time, and you're shepherding it into the next.
Yeah, I was helping it grow.
Yeah.
I was helping it grow.
That's a great way to look at it. Well, this has been super fun and really enlightening for me, and I've really enjoyed chatting with you, and I don't know, man, this was cool. I feel like there's a lot more similarity, I guess, you know, from from small to big than I probably realized before I walked in here.
Yeah, there is. There is a lot, Lars. Look, at the end of the day, you and I, we are custodians of the art and science of brand in some ways as well.
Yeah.
You know, I think for me, the first branding happened on commodity products. It was cattle. That's where the word comes from. There were farmers who had learned to tame cattle. And it was impossible to know one cow from the other or your herd of cows and sheep from the other. Very painful and some would say a cruel thing. The only way to differentiate a commodity was to brand it. Mm. Right?
Yeah, I get you.
That's where the word brand yeah. comes from. And I think what you've done in fashion, essentially, you know, it's a phone case or a shirt. It's a commodity. And you brand it and you differentiate it from other shirts. And in my case, I've done it in games and then at a corporate level. We're kind of doing the same thing, but the future is also very exciting. I don't know what's going to happen in an AI age and whether folks like you and me have, you know, which is why probably I'm spending too much time learning AI. So.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I wish you all the success in your new gig, which is not announced yet.
Yeah.
We'll know soon. So maybe we'll have to do a follow-up on that down the road a bit. But thank you for joining me today, Rahul. It's been
Thanks,
a total
Ryan.
Pleasure. This has been awesome.
It's been awesome being here. Thank you so much for giving me this chance. Yeah,
great.
Pretty cool.
Thank you.